So many of you know that about 3 months ago, we got a puppy. She is now 5 months old. And she started off 12 pounds, now she's 52 pounds. So you get a chance to see life kind of exploding in front of you. And it's been quite a wonderful experience of not only enjoying to get to know our dog, her name is Sabby, but actually it's made me really reflect on what kind of leader I am. Maybe reflect on not just if I can lead people, but can you lead a dog? Because it's not the same thing sometimes. And in fact, there are some overlap, but it actually is, you know, there's a lot of learning to happen as you are a dog owner. And I actually had two big dogs before, so I did some of that learning before. But in the midst of my learning, actually, I kind of came across some of the interesting parts of what it means to be a dog trainer, a dog owner, or a pack leader, as they're using these days. I found that Sabby, especially now, she's getting much bigger. If I don't have that trust basis worked out with her, the stakes are higher. She's big. Sometimes I'm sleeping and she'll like jump on top of me. That's 50 pound of dog, and actually it hurts. And she's gonna end up being about 80 pounds, and so I gotta get this leadership thing done right. But she's really good, actually. Without distraction, she follows through all things. She's a little stubborn. But at times, I kind of look to get a sense of, where can I learn more about leading my dog? She's got her fundamentals down. She can sit, she can go down. There's a few tricks we taught her, but she actually walks well. She loves people. We're trying to socialize her with dogs, but sorry for the all the dog updates. But what I learned was, do you guys know who this person is? His name is Cesar Millan. He's called the Dog Whisperer because he like understands dog. He understands their body language. And he goes and he actually takes care of dogs that are just really, really like have baggage. Either they're really aggressive or they're really fearful. Sometimes they're aggressive because they're fearful. And just watching him, he just knows how to move and he knows how to interpret. And he actually brings these dogs out of these little, out of these issues. He's an amazing dog trainer. I looked at how much it would cost to have a weekend with him out in Southern California. $5,000 for you and your dog. That's crazy. $5,000. And if people pay to have this guy train them, because actually that's what it's all about. When you're having a dog, you're a dog owner. It's less about how great the dog is. In fact, when you go to a class, the trainer is training you, not the dog. The trainer is training you as the person, as the pack leader. And he actually outlines two very specific things that he identifies as this is what it means to be a good leader of a dog. Dogs follow this kind of leadership. The first one is you have to be calm. He uses the language of you have to be a calm energy. In other words, if you're all frantic, if you don't have a lot of conviction, and you're kind of all 10 different directions at the same time, sometimes you see this. Dog owners screaming at their dogs, I said sit, 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 and the dog's just looking at them, right? Because they're so frustrated. Dogs don't follow that. There has to be a calm energy, a poise, a centeredness that dogs kind of pay attention to. The second thing, you have to be assertive, you have to be clear. You have to kind of like know what you're asking the dog and make it clear enough for the dog to follow. Well, it's interesting that he starts talking about how dogs will not follow unstable humans, yeah? He says, in all of the animal kingdom that he's seen, no animal follows an unstable leader, except human beings. Isn't that interesting? His comment is, animals don't follow unstable leaders, only humans have leaders who lie and get away with it. It's kind of a way to understand that dogs look at how you live, how you approach them, the relationship with trust that's built up. And so if they see you're consistent, and they see that you're true to your word, they're clear and you're true, they will follow you. It's only humans who, for whatever reason, when they look for leadership, they don't necessarily look for, no, I'm not talking about calm and assertive energy, character. Human people will follow somebody who's really charismatic, who says, does a great talk. They don't necessarily always follow whether they walk their talk. We're looking at leadership today as we're walking through the book of 1 Timothy. We're in a series called Core Training as we reflect on the Apostle Paul speaking into the life of the church that Timothy is at, realizing that at the core, there are some very, very core principles that they're actually not doing very well with. One of them is leadership. And he's trying to kind of give them and us a strong, strong foundation based on understand what is godly leadership, healthy leadership, leadership that brings life. When in fact, our culture, and even in our church culture sometimes, we're really following a different track where we're not looking for character. We're not looking for consistency. We're not looking for integrity. But in fact, we're being led by different kinds of leadership. So what I want to do today is I want to walk through 16 verses, which is almost impossible. I spoke like twice as fast over there, and it took me 40 minutes, so I have to cut some stuff out. Because it's very hard to walk over 16 verses word by word. But what I'm going to do is I'm trying to give you a good framework to understand this chapter, and also try to come away with some take-homes of what does good leadership look like? Where are we in terms of our own understanding? What is the DNA of our church in terms of how we build up and how can we move forward in a kind of leadership that actually is both biblical and solid as character-based? First and foremost, as we look at this passage, we see that there are two words, titles that are used to describe what is he getting after. The first title is in chapter 1, verse 1. It's called overseer. It is a word that's used to describe somebody who actually oversees different kinds of aspects of ministry, a leader in the church. I'm going to walk you through some formats of this. Another kind of word used to describe a leader in the church is deacon. I mean, you might have heard those words before. A deacon, somebody actually, that word deacon comes from the word to serve. And so they kind of like, they're the hands-on aspects of the church and doing things, while the overseers are the ones who are, you can use or management, but taking care of the trees in the forest and so on and so forth. But if you pay attention, there's another word that's also used, and it's the word elder. Have you heard of that before? Elder, if you're coming from a certain church settings, like a Presbyterian church, that's the key word for leader, elder. And they're used sometimes interchangeably, and it's a little confusing. Here's the problem. When we look at the first century church, they're developing their structures. They're developing their understanding. It's not exactly the same in every circumstance. And I think it's a very healthy thing to realize that structures and leadership in organization can be a little different according to the setting. But there is a general principle that we're going to lay out here for us to understand not only what do we read when we read in 1 Timothy, when we read in Titus, when we read, and how to understand how we do our sense of leadership. First and foremost, largely there are two groups that's outlined in the New Testament churches, deacons and elders. And in our kind of, if you're an Asian, you're more coming from a hierarchical context. Well, elders are up here and deacons are down here. You never see that in the scriptures. You see them as actually functioning together as a team, but they're two different kinds of types. The deacons who are doing the ministry and the elders who are overseeing and who are caring for, are teaching and guiding and so on and so forth. Well, where does this word overseer come into play, by the way? So this is the structure of the church format and leadership. You know, if you're corporate, you always want to know the org structure and so on and so forth. This is their org structure, right? Where does the word overseer come from? Overseer, in this setting, looks like it's actually going to be somebody who oversees the elders, okay? So there's even churches, by the way, who set up their structures in such a way that you've got one major overseer, and then you've got a bunch of other kind of leaders and so on and so forth. In fact, there's a church called the Episcopalian Church. That comes from the word which overseer comes from, episkopos. And it's like one bishop, one big dude that oversees lots of churches, or one regional leader who oversees lots of house churches, which are led by an elder at each church. All these structures are ways to interpret the passage that we're seeing. I actually see it a little differently here. I see it as elders are a title used to describe status. Okay? Usually you're an elder because you've got white hair and you've been in the community. Everybody knows you. You've established yourself. So it's a function that's kind of a word that's been pulled in from the Jewish context. In fact, the Jewish synagogues had the same kind of structure. Overseer is better understood maybe as an elder, but it's in reference. It's the same thing, but in reference to what overseer does. It's a functional word. So sorry for the typo here or the misappropriation, but think of elder as status. Think of overseer as function, okay? This is a little technical here, but I want you to understand that there's a structure in churches. Especially when there's life, you have to have structure, okay? You have to have an idea of how do you move, how do you interact, how do you move together. Well, this is the structure in our church for you to kind of get a quick glance at. We have different groupings of ministries that are moving together in our mission. And we have different leaders. The faces that you see are what we call the LT, or leadership team, so on and so forth. And so they oversee these smaller groupings of ministries, and they kind of liaison with them, they mentor them, they encourage them, and so on and so forth. This is the way our structure runs according to our mission. Just not to spend a lot of time here, so if you go to your app, you'll see this picture on the bulletin, as well as access to more descriptions of what each of these teams do, and so on and so forth, just if you're interested. Because structure is important. It allows us to actually move together for the sake of mission, even. But I can tell you, whenever we actually ask for leadership for their pictures, nobody wants. That's why their pictures are not so great up here. Nobody wants to give them. Nobody wants to say, I am a leader, right? In our context, if you're a leader, you're easily criticized, especially if it's your volunteer position. You don't get a lot of support. You don't get a lot of affirmation or encouragement. And so nobody wants to be a leader. Like, what do you get out of it? In fact, if you pay attention to what's happening in the level of Christian leadership, pastors who are going into seminary for the intention of being a pastor, those numbers have continually dropped. It's dried up quite a bit. Nobody wants to be a leader. I find it quite interesting that in this setting, and I think there's a reason why too, but in this setting too, in church in Ephesus, Paul actually has to encourage people that leadership and stepping into leadership in the church, it is a beautiful thing. It is a significantly important thing, and ultimately, it is a rewarding thing. I think one of the reasons why nobody wants to say I'm a leader is because we've seen bad leaders. Okay, we've grown up amongst maybe even those who had an elder title, but we saw their lives, and it wasn't very congruent with their talk and their walk wasn't the same. We saw poor leadership, angry leadership, and so and not many of us like I'm gonna fix this. We're coming from a very hypercritical environment. If you watch most of the guys watch the NBA, maybe the ladies too, NBA Finals. Everybody talks about LeBron, and they micro criticize every little thing that he does. If he passes it to an open teammate at the last minute, they're like, "Oh, you should have taken it yourself." You know, if he takes a shot and he misses it, "Oh, you're not the greatest in the world." We micro criticize everything. Nobody wants to be a leader. I find it very interesting that Paul actually starts off by saying, here's a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer, okay, a fairly significant leadership role and task, they desire a noble thing, a grand, beautiful, worthwhile thing. Actually, he's talking to people who've experienced bad leadership, and most likely those leaders are out. Now there's a leadership vacuum, and they have to process, okay, how are we going to fill in these leadership roles? When we've had an experience of bad leadership, he actually has to say, it is still such an important thing. Why is it so important? Well, you think about it. Later on in this passage, you find that he actually references that, I'm on my way, this is verse 15, I can point to you if you want. I'm on my way, and this is, here we go. And he tells the church, if I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household. This is God's family, okay? Where he resides, where his ways are revealed, okay? He says, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation, the truth. The church reveals what God looks like, how his family looks like, how heaven is going to operate in, ultimately. We are like the prototype for everybody to see what community can be and should be. And so, if there's bad leadership in the church that does not reveal God's goodness, God's holiness, God's love and hospitality, then guess what? People see that and they misinterpret, they misunderstand. And it's very easy to make up our ammunition to say, this is the God that you worship? This is why it's significant. Without good Christian leadership, people actually aren't able to grow in not only their sense of Christ-likeness, but also we're not able to really reveal Christ and do our mission in the world. So he has to say, if you are called to lead, if there's some prompting in you, if you are asked, okay, if you aspire to lead, that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. Most of us, if we're asked to do this, we're like, oh, I'm not so sure, especially if you're Asian. Many of us in this room are Asian. We're like, we have to do the threefold. No, 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 I couldn't do it with a passive aggressive. No, I couldn't do it. And we're waiting for them to kind of keep asking. No, no, there should be a healthy expression of, if I'm asked, I'm going to really pray through it. I'm gonna really think through it. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. I love this. At the end, he kind of reminds those who are going to be deacons as well as overseers. If you respond to the call and aspire to lead and you do it well, those who have served well, there are rewards in this life and the next. You gain an excellent standing amongst the church, an excellent standing even amongst the neighborhoods and the people who are watching, and a great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. What does that mean? How is it that if you serve well, you get a great assurance in your faith? Many times people say, if you lead, man, you get beat up, you get bruised, and your faith actually doesn't necessarily grow. But actually, this is a different response that we're hearing. When you serve well, something happens, both in terms of what you can reveal to other people, but you get this conviction that grows in your own faith. I reflected on this even as a pastor. I've been doing this for quite a while, since 1999. And I look at my own life and I look at my own self, and I'm not the most, I'm far from a perfect person. And I always felt like, wow, there's so many people I look up to. God, why would you call me into leadership? Call me into pastoral ministry even. And I look back at my life and I look at all the places where, and in my journey, and I realize that amidst of all of that, because of having to serve, because of having to be in positions where I have to trust him and depend on him, sometimes, you know, be criticized, but also sometimes just delight in what God's doing, even through some of the things that I've been a part of, an assurance is coming in faith. I feel like if I wasn't a pastor, and a lot of pastors say this, you know, I don't know where I would be in Christ. Now, it doesn't mean that if you have issues with God that you should just go into be a pastor, or if you've got moral issues that's going to save you. No. What it means is there's something that's built up when you serve, and when you serve well, you emerge purer, stronger. Your faith is greatly assured. In fact, there's an excellent standing that emerges. I just want to share this because I think our culture, especially our church culture sometimes, we are very gun-shy. We don't want to step up. We don't want to say, I'm a leader, I'm willing to lead. Even those who have great leadership gifts won't step up. Okay? We have incredible leaders here who are stepping up, but sometimes there are blocks. And I want us to reflect on, why would Paul tell this to Timothy and to the church in Ephesus and to us? Okay? There are strong encouragements to lead. I think one of the reasons why it's hard to lead is because look at the standards that he's going to put up. So, looking forward, he's going to describe this role as an overseer, an elder, and then say, this is the qualification. This is what you have to have in your life. You have to be above reproach. Okay? That's a tough word. That means nobody, when they look at you, can find any fault. Like, what? Other translations, you have to be blameless. That's a scary thing, okay? Because all I know is in my own family, I get blamed all the time for like, oh, you forgot this. It's like, oh, how can you be blameless? How can you be blameless? The language here is not perfect. It means what you're about, how you live, how you intend, and how you follow through is that there's a deep sincerity toward a strong and high, consistent character, okay? That you don't take this casually. You are deeply invested in a high character. The word is character. That leadership in the church, the first and the most clear qualification is not just your giftedness. It's not just whether people like you or will follow you, or you can attract a crowd. It's actually character. It's character. The word for character, as we understand it, is a word picture. It's in the original languages. When you take a piece of stone and you begin to carve or etch, you know, repeatedly again and again and again, so many times that a character emerges, something emerges, a picture or a font or something, a letter or whatever, or a word emerges. Or you're chiseling away, and if you've ever had to do this, it's actually not an easy thing. You have to put a lot of energy and care into it, and repeatedly. But when you're done, what emerges is something that is lasting. So much so that when you rub up against it, right, it leaves a mark. It leaves a specific mark. That's the word for character. Something that has been consistently been built into you, trained into you, so that now this is who you are. When you just turn this way, you leave a mark on another person. Your character is actually rubbing off on the people. That's what they see, that's what they feel. And it's a beautiful word. And this is the primary word for leadership here. Now, it doesn't mean that you care less about gifting. I know some people who are incredibly wonderful persons, the soundest and deepest character, but they don't have leadership gifts. They're called to do other things, okay? So it's not saying that you shouldn't think about giftings, because other places, it actually says in Romans chapter 12, it says, if you have the gift of leadership, you should lead, right? But what it's saying is, beyond just the gift of leadership, even before, it is, do we have this recognition that the primary qualification in the church and for biblical leadership, even outside the church, the companies and our government, it's character. I don't know if you've actually really wrestled with this or not, if you thought about it or not. The church used to be the place where you heard this, where we made it a core value. We fought for this, and we said, even against the rest of the world, that character matters in a leader. If you look at this little graph, it's kind of hard to tell. I'm gonna help you a little. This graph actually traces what's happened in the church, in the church's understanding of whether character matters from 2011 to 2016, 5 years. 2011, the rest of the world, America said that, does character matter? That's what you asked. Okay, so it's kind of like the question, specific question is, can you have bad personal character in your family life and in your own personal life and still lead well? Okay, so do you care about whether they have an affair? Do you care if they had some not so, up and up things in their personal finances? Do you care if there's personal character? And in fact, the rest of the America said, 44% said, we don't care. Okay. You can be a good leader, even if your personal life is kind of fishy. That's what they said. Okay. At that time, the church said 30% no. In other words, 30% said, yeah, you can still be a good leader even if your personal life is a mess. Right? 70% said, character matters. I don't want a leader, even in our government, whose their own personal life is a mess. Because I can't trust them. Okay? Character matters. Do you know what happened in 5 years? That green, if you look, is the 2016 mark. Almost everywhere except for one area, the unaffiliated, everybody said, character doesn't matter. Character doesn't matter. But this is the scary part. That second graphic, the second bar pattern, that's the white evangelical Protestants. They were the ones who said 30%. Only 30% believe that character matters. Guess what? Now it's switched around. Now 72% said it doesn't matter. That means only 28% think that it matters. Do you know how huge a flip that is? That means compared to the rest of America, we're telling America character does not matter. The guy who put this together, he was so shocked, he actually said, this is the definition of selling your soul in order to get something. Because you think that a leader is going to give you something, you are completely blind to the fact that character matters. I'm finding that this is quite a test for us, not just our country, but our community as well, just in general, just in churches as well. You hear a lot about pastors who have these horrible scandals and have to step down from ministry. You see it from a larger scope of a church out in Seattle. This guy was built this incredible, well-organized, amazing group of churches, and then he has stepped down because it was demonstrated that he had this incredible forcefulness, anger, and almost oppressive control on other people. You see it actually even in our area. 2 years ago, I ended up taking a sabbatical because something in me just really freaked out. I was coming into awareness of, wow, I'm approaching the year 47. I don't know if you guys know, but my spiritual director told me that 47, age 47 is the year that you see the most moral failure amongst pastors. That's the year. Yeah. So I was like, oh my gosh, I'm approaching 47. And then I was There actually were several huge profile scandals coming in our own context in the Tri-Cities area, of well-respected pastors with great, profound ministries, who were actually being revealed that there was underneath of it there was a lot of brokenness. One guy actually, who was in his 50s, it was revealed that he had an 11-year affair. I did the math, and it was right at the time where I was, about 46 years old. And I was like, oh. You know, 47's coming, and I look at like this guy actually started his road down that way, and actually I spent time really wrestling with God and this issue too, getting help and really processing this. I'm so thankful for a church that actually not only allowed me to do that, but actually is calling me to account, calling our leaders to account. Character matters, because what happens not only to the churches who have leaders who have these moral failures now. Leaders are imperfect. They are going to fail at times. You can't expect a leader to be perfect, but we have to call leaders into account. We have to help them. Because what happens when there's moral failure like this? Inside the church, the people actually can lose their sense of faith. It can just hit them hard. Maybe we've experienced some of that in our own lives. But outside the church, guess what? It just adds so much ammunition, and it blinds people to actually the reality who Christ is. What is this character of being above reproach? That's Christ-like character. Character so it matters, so much so that we have to pay attention to it. We have to reflect on it and build it into our church systems even. We're going to see 12 different things, and I'm not going to go through every one of them in the same amount of time, but I do have to go through some because some of them are a little misleading. But I want you to know that we've actually done this in our church context. We've looked through this list of character dynamics and also in Titus chapter 1. And we've put together 33 different character and competency benchmarks. And when we call our senior leaders, our leadership team leaders, we reflect on this. And this is kind of hard to do because you're a little like, oh, that's a little invasive. But we ask ourselves, does this person look like this? Do they reveal a character that's based off of this passage and a similar one in Titus chapter 1. The reason why this is important is because we're going to actually vote as a community two new leadership team members on July 1st. So we have to know that we take this seriously. That list is going to be made available to you. I tried to get it up on the app, but it didn't work this time through. We'll make it available to you. But you're going to have a chance to reflect on this. What's leadership look like? Character-led leadership look like in our setting too? Let me work through really quickly. Above reproach is the general title for what all of these different specifics look like. For the deacons, there's going to be like a different word for it, but it's the same idea, okay? That they are deeply respectable. Something about their life oozes character, okay? And this is the breakdown. They are called to be faithful. He's called to be faithful to his wife. In some passages, if you can read, husband of one wife, okay? Now, if you read husband of one wife, what does that mean? If you want to be an overseer or elder, it means what? And people do it, read it like this. Women are not being in leadership. By the way, if you were here for my last Sunday service, you would realize it's a whole long story. Look it up. But no. This passage actually is not saying just husband of one wife. Because if you take it that literally, that means single people can't be leaders, can't be pastors, can't be elders, right? But wait a minute. Paul doesn't have a wife. So is Paul saying, well, you know, do as I say, not as I do? This phrase actually doesn't mean marital status. That's not the emphasis of this phrase. This phrase talks about covenantal faithfulness. That somebody in their marriage relationship, if they're married, looks like that they have a deep fidelity, both sexually and relationally, with their spouse. But to apply that principle, it means there's a chastity, there's a faithfulness. You take this seriously, okay? That's the first thing. Isn't that interesting? So it doesn't mean marital status. It means faithfulness to your wife or to your spouse or as a single person, faithfulness in your relationships and even in your sexual relationships. Chastity, that is. Temperate, self-controlled, respectable. Doesn't that sound like calm energy, right? That you're not overindulging. You don't have to, there's no addictions in your life that's driving you places because there's something healed in you and being healed in you. You are sound in who you are. This doesn't mean that you have overly disciplined and you have complete self-control. It means that you've yielded your control and your urges to the Spirit And you don't look like somebody who is just out to gratify your appetites. I love this one. The next one, hospitable. In order to be a leader in the church, you have to have an open home and an open heart to be able to greet and receive not only your friends, but that word for hospitable means strangers. Okay? It means people that you don't know very well, maybe not like very well. You have to have this graciousness about you. These are descriptions of what Christ looks like. Someone who is able to teach. Doesn't mean that you have to be gifted as a teacher, but there's something in your life that is worthy to share. What you've learned, what you've experienced. Moving forward. Sorry. Not given to drunkenness. Why is this important? Because actually, what happens to somebody, what does it describe of somebody who is overly and easily given over to drunkenness? It means not only the lack of self-control, they put themselves in situations where their words and their actions are can do extremely dangerous things. Not violent, but gentle. Not quarrelsome, and not a lover of money. He must manage, or he or she must manage their family, own family well, and see that his children obey him, and must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. You should be able to see their character in their family life. That is one of the best tests. Yeah. When I was growing up, my dad used to tell me this passage, and he would say, I'm an elder of the church. You have to obey me, or else I'll get shamed by everybody else. I had this guilt complex. Like, if I ever do something wrong, I have ruined my dad's reputation. Anybody feel that? Pastor's children feel that in many kinds of ways? That passage is not meant to say that children have to show themselves to be perfect in front of everybody else. It means you should be able to see this very healthy leadership role in the home. I interpret it as, guess what? Because you see the next passage, it says, anyone who does not manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? If you are a leader in the church, you should be able to, and you should be discipling well in your own family. Yeah. Something about a Christ-likeness should be making impact in your own children, that they respect you. Kind of like Sabby, you know, if I come up around you and she's excited and she doesn't listen to me at all, she like jumps all over you and I say, sit, and she doesn't, then you know that my relationship with her has a long way to go. If in fact she comes and I say, sit, and she sits, you'd be like, oh, she's well-trained. There's a trust relationship. It's not about obedience for the sake of status. It's about trust that's been built up because that's healthy leadership. I'm going to move forward. He or she must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he might fall into disgrace and into a devil's trap. And so on. So when we look at the deacons, it's very similar. They have to be worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in wine, not pursuing dishonest gain. My time frame is really, really closing up. But you can read this for yourself, but in continuing it on, it's the same kind of format. High character for deacons, high character for elders. But if you were to take a step back and reflect on all these different aspects of what does it qualify you? What is in the character resume for somebody to be a leader? This is not just for elders, LT members, or church leaders or pastors. All of this, not to be a lover of money, not to be so caught up in indulging and gratifying the flesh, to have a family where you disciple well and lead well and have a healthy family. These are all both the calling and the inheritance of every believer. So this is not saying you have to be a super Christian. This is more of saying you have to be accountable to live and walk what you talk. Does that make sense? Yeah. It's not saying you have to be perfect. It's saying this is what a Christian really looks like. And we want to hold fast that our leaders definitely have the support and accountability to do so. So much so that later on, 1 Timothy chapter 5:22, it says, do not be hasty in the laying on of hands. You, like Moses would do with Joshua, he would give ministry and authority by laying on of hands, saying, don't be quick just to throw anybody into leadership. Okay? Make sure that they have grown into and living out this high level of character. It means we have to be open to and be able to build in systems of accountability. That as leaders are being groomed into, they are being mentored. They're being encouraged. They're seeing what good leadership looks like. They're seeing people who are not just reacting in anger or in vengeance. Their words are controlled by the Spirit. They're not just going off in different directions, but their life and their lifestyle is of a high character. And that's actually what we're going to be emphasizing this summer and coming in the fall. Pastor Richard and I actually are going to build up and really seek to build up systems of mentoring. Because I think we have incredible leaders that are coming up in the next generation. But incredible gifting, incredible perspectives. But without character, we're going to be in big trouble going forward. Not only as in the church, but also as a generation. I want to have you bow your heads with me.